everybody. What's going on? Welcome to CommanderCast, the Commander / EDH podcast about community, technology, and strategy. My name is Andy, a.k.a. Ghosts, with three O's and plural all over the internet. I am the podcast director and producer. I'm a league organizer locally, and I'm the more casual guy on the podcast. Don't expect the cutthroat technology or strategy from me. I'm more or less here to do the technical stuff and just keep it real. Today, doing this podcast with me, I got my man Carlos, just emerging from the Arcane Lab. So why don't you introduce yourself, Carlos?
Hi, I'm Carlos. I like to build an awful lot of decks, and I'm always going to be playing something a little bit different and hopefully unique. And my favorite general is my Child of Alara deck, the land-based deck that's kind of taken off as of recently. There's a lot more interest than there was before.
Okay, so if you're not aware, Carlos is the author of a regular series called The Arcane Lab, which runs at CommanderCast pretty much weekly. Well, why don't you explain it, Carlos?
So the idea behind this is hopefully at some point people are going to... I'm going to write enough articles and hopefully they're helpful enough that people will start taking it seriously and like actually ask for help. But we'll have to wait and see if anyone feels like listening to me. But until then, I'm going to be taking like taking different looks at different kinds of generals that either don't see much play or taking a look at a budget build of the deck or putting different kinds of constraints on the deck building to make it interesting and kind of keep things fresh and fight against the hive mind that's taking over competitive EDH or whatever.
So if you've got a deck that seems like it's struggling a little bit, maybe you're not sure which direction you want to take it in, or maybe you're just actually building a new deck and you're not sure what cards to cut here and there, that kind of thing. Don't be afraid to drop Carlos a line. What's the email, Carlos?
You can get me at cag5383@gmail.com.
Okay, so that's our direct line to the Arcane Lab and Dr. Carlos. I guess, is it Dr. Professor? I'm not sure. Okay, so that's it for that. We've got a pretty decent episode lined up for you guys here, but so that you are aware, this is a canned episode. This is being aired in the event that we're not able to put a podcast together for the week, so don't expect any recent news or anything like that on this one, but I don't think we're going to be lacking for content here either. So that said, we're going to move right into our community segment. This week in community, we're going to be doing a subject I'm calling In Defense of Blue. Now, blue is the color that's generally considered the strongest in EDH / Commander by most of the more hardcore player community. The more competitive community bases the majority of their decks around the color blue. And there's kind of a widespread understanding that, yeah, blue is probably the strongest color. Green's creeping on it as of late, make no mistake, but blue is generally accepted as the top dog. So with that, you get a lot of complaints about how blue is oppressive, blue's overpowered, blue's got too much stuff going on, and blue might not even be promoting the kind of games that the typical commander player is interested in seeing, which generally encompasses, and this doesn't include all play groups, but just we obviously have to speak in generalizations for us to have a meaningful discussion here. So most of the time when people sit down and want to play commander, they want to play a longer game that's more interactive, with quote-unquote crazy things going on all over the place like we talk about in legendary plays. And blue is kind of the color that says, I don't know about that, guys. Let's not get too crazy here until it's my turn to get crazy. Or at least that's the reputation it has. And blue decks are widely reviled. I think that's fair to say. A lot of people hate blue decks. I know when I see a mono blue deck sit down across from me, it's almost like putting an actual like red dot on their head coming out of my eyes that says, I have to plug this immediately. You know, you got to deal with this guy. So do you see things in the same kind of light, Carlos? Like when a blue guy sits down, we did a Hate It Out segment on mono blue, you know? So are you kind of seeing the same thing?
I definitely agree. I think the problem is that a lot of the things that blue can do tend to either slow the game down or lock people out of the game. Like, let's be honest, almost every single mono blue general has a way to lock the game down or at least slow it down to a crawl.
Yeah, the strong top tier ones are generally lockout generals or combo generals.
Right, and so, I mean, it's really hard to deal with that, especially when blue is the color to draw infinite cards, to counter all your spells, to force their stuff through. So if someone's trying to build a deck like that, odds are that it's going to be pretty powerful and it's going to succeed pretty often. That doesn't mean that blue can't be played fairly, it's just that the people who are playing it don't tend to play it fairly.
Okay, now in terms of it being played fairly, this episode I'm actually going to stick up for blue and defend it, and I'm going to try to give some reasons why it's not the monster that people make it out to be. Because a lot of the times you'll have a guy sit down with a mono blue deck and it might not be what you're expecting it to be. It might not be a typical lockdown, draw a million cards, do nothing until I Stroke of Genius you to death deck. It might be just a blue aggro deck for all you know. And I don't see that as being especially offensive. So when it comes to blue, one of the primary complaints is counter spells. I think this has been a long-running thing. I, as long as I've played Magic, people have complained about counterspells. So what do you think is offensive about counterspells, Carlos, as opposed to having... When your creature gets hit by Remove Soul, what's worse about that than having hit by Doomblade?
Honestly, I really don't know what's worse about that. I know R&D has put out all kinds of articles, and they always say that people are fine with getting their guy killed, but they hate getting it countered. And I think the problem is that when something gets countered, it's a lot more like they're saying, no, you can't play the game. Where when they have a removal spell, it's kind of like, okay, you had an answer, now we can move on.
Like, it's a one-for-one answer. So I don't know why people are so uppity about counterspells. Like, I think a lot of people over-rely on Enters the Battlefield triggers now, especially in Commander, and I think maybe that's the reason behind some of the sour grapes. Like, they're used to their, especially creatures, they're used to them getting some value out of them, whether they ever actually do anything creature-ish or not, like attack.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it's also that a lot of counterspells answer... anything. So like you have to use your counter spell before something comes into play. Once it enters the battlefield, it's over. You can't deal with it. But you can use your cryptic command or your counter spell or whatever to answer absolutely anything. And so I guess part of the animosity towards blue is that its share of the color pie is a little bit of everything. So it can do pretty much whatever it wants. And you don't really know what to expect. It's hard to anticipate what they're gonna do. It's hard to play around it, and like, it can be really difficult to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we're talking about multiplayer EDH, my thing with counterspells, and I think they're good, I think a certain number of counterspells promotes a healthy environment as opposed to one that's just frustrating, like a lot of people talk about. I don't think that a guy, even that's just sitting there with his counterspell deck, is promoting a game of inactivity and non-playing. I think that's people that are unwilling to force the issue. Like, one guy's going to get a spell countered during a rotation. Somebody's just got to take that. If a whole table is sitting there paralyzed in fear because a guy has Cryptic Command mana up, then that's not the fault of the counterspell player. That's the fault of everyone not being willing to lose one spell so everyone can play.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It's actually something that I've been talking about more and more on the various forums and whatever, is that people who are playing in such a way that just extends the game, that just drags it out, that's really what starts to bother people. And so I think part of the problem with blue is that everyone's afraid to try to do things when there's a blue player that has double blue open. And so even if they don't have the counter spell, or even if it's not a big deal if you get something countered, it just drags the game out because people are afraid.
Now, the other thing with counter spells that I want to raise too, Adam's brought this up before, is that no one likes the guy with the counter spells until he counters the Insurrection, and then he's a superhero. So like, I think it's important to recognize that instead of just when it's working for you, you've got to recognize that blue is what actually can make games way more interesting, because especially as they continue to print these cards that are, I think, in some cases outlandish, like the Praetor's Council, that new green card from Mirrored and Besieged, where it returns all the cards in your graveyard to your hand, and then you have no maximum hand size. I don't think anyone's going to be jeering when the blue guy counters that spell. You know what I'm saying? Like, blue will keep people in the game and make sure the game is interactive and longer, which is what a lot of people want when they're playing EDH. And in many cases, no other color and no other kind of spell could have done that.
I definitely agree. Like, Wrath of Gods are in the format to keep creature decks honest. Counter spells are in the format to keep, like, giant spells like that honest. And I think people need to realize that sometimes you're the one who wants the blue player to counter Stormherd, and sometimes you're the one who's casting Stormherd. And you need to be able to see both sides of that instead of just the downside.
Yeah, for sure. Now, like we were saying before, do you think that blue necessarily promotes non-interactive play? Because there are a lot of cards in blue that are combo pieces. Like, Mind Over Matter, I think, is the most kind of egregious offender in this category, because I've never seen anyone do it for anything but an infinite combo. But I don't think that that's a fair accusation, because there's cards in every color that do nothing but that, and there's artifacts that do nothing but combo. So do you think it's fair that blue gets that stereotype cast on it? Because I don't really see it as being a fair template to cast on an entire category of decks.
I mean, it is and it isn't. There was a time over the summer where I tried to build just about every single mono blue deck I could think of, and I hated playing almost every single one of them because I felt like even if I was trying to build a fun deck, I ended up locking people out and doing things that prevented other people from playing the game. So I think the problem is that people fall into the trap of just playing all the good blue cards, which do tend to be ones that make the game difficult for everyone else. And if you make some kind of conscious effort to get rid of some of those and include things that are a little bit more interactive, then the deck becomes a lot more fun.
Yeah, I was going to ask, because I don't think that's true. I don't think that blue decks are kind of inherently oppressive, even if you use most of the good cards, because it's all about how you build your deck. Like, you can build an equally oppressive, unpleasant mono green deck that does nothing but sit there, play lands really fast, and then play something before anybody's tempo can catch up. You're so far ahead that no one else really got to play the game, ultimately, which to me is essentially the same as getting your four spells out with Storm and flipping over your Aurea with Arcane Lab in play. It's just a different context, and I don't know why that's viewed as being different, or the guy playing Armageddon on the third turn when he's the only person with a reasonable beater in play, and that eventually lets him take away the game. Like, I just don't think that that's that different. I don't think blue is the go-to color for that. Like, if anything, I think white is the go-to color for drawing the game out needlessly and making it boring.
I think it depends, and it keeps coming back to this idea of drawing the game out. People want the game to be over, so when someone has...
But at the same time, people want the game to run on forever. This is what I don't understand. You know what I'm saying? Like, people say they want longer games, but then they're always angry when someone draws a game out. Like, what's the context here that we... Like, what's the difference between the two?
So I guess the difference to me is that when you're playing Tides About Tyrants and locking people out of the game isn't over. You still have to find a way to win. Where when someone has the Azusa deck and the Nutsdraw, the game's over on, like, turn five, and you can just shuffle up and start over again.
You see, but when you can see things are going that way with the blue player, like, isn't it just as much your responsibility to concede and move on with the game? Like, if you know there's no way you can win, why don't you just give up?
There's always those one or two people that just want to see them play it out to make sure that they can. Like, when someone's taking infinite time stretch turns or whatever, they still want you to show them that you have the win. And so if one person doesn't scoop, then you're just sitting there while they play their deck for 20 minutes anyway.
See, but that's what I'm saying. I don't think that's the fault of the blue player.
No, it's definitely not.
Yeah, I think that's the fault of guys that just don't know when to throw in the towel. And throwing in the towel isn't a bad thing. This is Commander. You know, is there money on the line? I don't know. I've never played with money on the line in Commander. There are probably people out there that do, but does it really matter? Like, if a guy's won, let him win. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I mean, there's this mentality that's hammered into people who play in tournaments. If someone's comboing off or whatever, you always make them show you the win condition.
Yeah,
there are those stories of, like, Mike Long and whatever. And so people carry that over into a casual format where, I mean, really, you're playing to have fun. If some guy's comboing off, he's had his fun, he's probably going to win. Start another game so you can try to have a better game next time.
Yeah. Okay, so I've kind of made my case on why I think that blue isn't, like, this oppressive monster that a lot of people make it out to be. I think it's just like every other color, where you have these tools, it's more or less a blank slate, and it's up to whatever the people building the deck choose to do with it. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's nothing inherently oppressive about blue. Some people would argue that because it's the color of counter spells, which I don't think are really that bad, and it has all these combo pieces, but every color has combo pieces, so I don't think blue deserves to be considered the one color that's going to promote no interactivity and a boring game and everyone sitting there locked in a stalemate, because we've all seen the white stasis decks. You know, we've all seen, how's that pronounced, Hiroki, the Dust Drinker?
Yeah.
In case you're not familiar with what he does, he's a 2-2 guy from Kamigawa, and he costs 4 mana, and he only lets everyone untap one land on their turn. So if you're not having fun yet just listening to that, I don't know what's going to convince you, you know? But, and white has the Armageddons, and they have all the Raz that make the creature decks have to sit there and stall forever to get anything done. So I think white is just as bad. And then we already went over the green thing, where green can play these stupid ramp decks that literally do nothing but ramp and then blow everyone out of the game before they have the chance. Between the fast mana you have access to, and unfettered access to all the best ramp cards ever printed in Magic, like, making these mono green decks isn't a huge accomplishment. It's not difficult, and it's super effective. And then in black, mono black control, between discard elements and the ability to repeatedly wipe creatures off the board, they can be super oppressive decks, I think. And I don't know if they're a whole lot necessarily easier to interact with just because they lack counter spells. Like, if you have no hand, what are you going to do? So, and red, I got nothing for red. I'm not going to lie there. Like, have you ever seen a red deck that makes the game really uninteractive?
I mean, there are those chaos decks that run like Group of Chaos and all those things. Those are really obnoxious. But
yeah, but they're not good strategies either.
No.
I don't think. Apparently Donovan has like technology related to that that's good. So I don't know what he, I honestly don't know what he's going to say, but I'm looking forward to it. Anyway, so that out of the way, do you think that blue can be a force for good in Commander? Like, do you think it comes down to card selection? Well, first of all, do you think it's possible? Do you think blue can be made without resorting to something obvious like a group hug deck that draws everyone cards, that blue can be sat down at the table and there's a way that you can cultivate a culture in your playgroup that doesn't make you the automatic target?
I think you can do it, but you have to put a lot more conscious effort into it than with most other colors. The thing is, there are so many infinite combos in blue, and there are so many things that are non-interactive and slow down the game, that it's hard to not include some of them. And invariably, those are going to be some of your best lines of play. And so you're going to make them most of the time. I think you definitely can. It just takes a little bit more effort, and you have to like tweak your deck to be a little bit more interactive. You need to cut some lock pieces. You need to cut some combo pieces, make it a little harder. Or, I mean, your group needs to meet you in the middle is really what it comes down to. They need to be willing to metagame a little bit against the blue deck, and you need to be willing to not try to combo everyone's face off as quickly as possible every game.
Yeah, I can see that. One of the big things I see, too, is blue splashed as a color in other decks. That makes decks way more interesting, if for no other reason, because you get to draw cards. Like, I've never seen games become as boring outside an actual hardlock combo as games where everyone's there. Like, you have a guy playing a Naya deck and a guy playing a big green deck and me playing a mono red deck or something. And we're all sitting there with our giant walls of creatures, like, waiting for someone to draw something that lets us get through. But we can't draw anymore because we're not playing blue and maybe we're not getting the situational draw cards we have in our decks. And those games get boring fast and no one's drawing answers and that kind of thing. So I think blue actually can speed games up and keep games more interactive, especially by enabling people to draw their answers that make the game interactive and draw the cards that let them win.
Yeah, blue definitely serves a role. And I think we need to understand that it does have a place in the metagame. It does fill a very specific role. It does help to move the game along or to prevent things from getting too out of control. And other decks are just as capable of slowing the game down or running away with the game as blue is. I think blue just has a bad rap because it's more capable of it because of all the card draw and things like that.
I think blue has also been historically more abused.
Yeah, for
like
sure.
Not only in the EDH context, but in all Magic. Like, that's just the way it is, you know. But I think, like we're seeing now, like, big green decks are super obnoxious now. Like, people are getting tired of those. They're starting to feel really played out, and they're everywhere. And I think people are going to come around to this idea that, you know what, maybe, like, green kind of had a reputation for being bad for a long time. In EDH,
it's definitely not.
Yeah, green is a house, and it's getting obnoxious, which I don't think anyone ever really thought would happen. So I think maybe people will start to come around and realize, you know what, every color can do this. This isn't just a blue thing. It's just that we're kind of conditioned to hate on blue after playing against it for so long. Because I said it a long time ago, I kind of had a rule when I sat down at a table, attack the combo player, attack the guy with islands, and then move on. And now, after playing more and more games, I'm starting to realize that's not really necessary, especially if you're playing with people that aren't interested in blowing a table out in four turns. Because maybe they're just, like, I have a friend, Duncan, he's playing a mono blue deck that's like an aggro deck with artifacts. Judging a book by its cover, if its general is like Arkham Dagson, yeah, I can see then. But then all the blue player has to do is, you know, pick something else. Like, it's not like you're lacking in blue legends.
Right. Yeah, I think the big thing is that people need to recognize that, like, every deck is, to some extent, a combo deck or a control deck. Like, there aren't very many straight-up aggressive decks in this format. The ramp decks are combo decks. The mono-white control decks are slowing down the game just like blue is, and every deck is capable of locking you out. Every color is capable of doing these things that blue is doing. Blue just kind of gets the worst end of it because it can do all of them at the same time.
Okay, so I'm sure that some people have their own defense for blue. Other people will continue to come at blue and call it the boogeyman of EDH and all that. Either way, we'd like to hear from you. You know the contact information. It's all going to be in the show notes, so get a hold of us and let us know what you think.
All right, in this week's strategy segment, we're going to be talking about trump cards. Every color has cards that, if they resolve, they tend to end the game very quickly. Things like Insurrection or Blatant Thievery, Myogen of Night's Reach, Praetor's Council, Tooth and Nail, Stormherd, all kinds of things like this. What we want to talk about is how often these things actually end the game as opposed to just making it difficult. What the best ways to deploy these kinds of things and protect yourself against them are. The best way to take advantage of these trump cards. This is a format that's kind of, a lot of people see it as throwing around giant powerful spells and things like that. And that's, these are really the things that...
They kind of epitomize that.
Yeah. And so it's really important to understand like what they actually do and how many of them actually end the game. And I mean, just going down this list, I've almost every Insurrection I've seen has ended the game. But I've seen Myogen of Night's Reach, Armageddon, and Praetor's Council resolve and not do very much. So I don't know, what kinds of cards have you seen that always end the game in your experience?
Well, that's my whole thing with this subject, is that all these cards that are allegedly I win buttons, it's really rare for me to actually see them instantly win the game, unless they're components of an actual infinite combo. I find it's extraordinarily rare for them to actually win, and I don't know if that reputation is necessarily deserved. Like, a couple of these cards I find are hugely overhyped. Like, my experience with Insurrection runs pretty contrary to yours, Carlos. Sometimes it will win the game, other times it will do nothing, or it will sit in somebody's hand forever, or the guy will just play it and it'll just get countered, and then he makes a frowny face, right? So I think that's kind of where we get into this idea that if you're going to play these spells, you have to know when to play them and how to protect them and make sure they actually happen. And that doesn't necessarily only entail counter spells, you know what I'm saying? Or redirection magic. Like, you got to be able to read the table when the time is appropriate. Like, Insurrection, yeah, it's obvious. Okay, people have lots of big creatures on the board. Hopefully everyone is tapped out. Let's play it. But how do you deal with it when somebody else casts it? That kind of thing is what I want to talk about. And a big one is Myogen of Night's Reach. Now, this card is widely hated because, in case you're not familiar with what it does, it's a legendary spirit from Kamigawa. It's a 5/3 for 8 mana, and it comes into play with the divinity counter on it that makes it indestructible. And when you remove the counter, everyone has to discard their hand but you. So people hate hand destruction in EDH. People seem to hate all kinds of good strategies in EDH, like land destruction and mass discard. And Myogen is apparently considered one of the more obnoxious cards in that category. But with all of these bombs, you have to be careful. And Myogen is the most prevalent example, because the second people see it played or even know it's in your deck, you are making yourself public enemy number one. Like, if you resolve Myogen of Night's Reach, and it's possible to do that early on with black decks because of Cabal Coffers, if people don't strip mine it for whatever reason and let it go. If you remove that counter and everyone discards their hand, every single card that is drawn until you are dead is going to go at you. Like, it's almost guaranteed. Because everyone will want you to get you back for ruining their plans and making them discard their hand. Because people hate having to do that. So if you're going to do that, you have to do it at a clutch time when you know it's actually going to win the game. You can't do it to try and secure it if it's kind of in the early game and you're thinking, well, everyone still has most of their life. If I do this now, maybe I have a good chance. That's when it's a trap. That's when it's a bad call to do that. You've got to wait till it's going to be the most devastating, when some of the resources are already depleted, everyone's already hurt a little bit, and you're kind of assured that you can actually take it home. Because otherwise, taking that counter off reads every spell played from now on attacks you. It doesn't matter if they don't have the same number of spells. Eventually, people are going to be able to draw cards, and eventually they're going to have a hand again. Like, unless you've already weakened them with something like an Exsanguinate, or everyone's been beating each other up all around the table. It's just, these cards are so politically poor that playing them makes you into the only target that remains. Blatant Thievery is another example, because people hate having their stuff stolen. Like, when someone steals my thing with Blatant Thievery, a lot of the time, I want that thing back. I don't even care if it was good. Like, if they stole my bullwhip, you're giving me my fucking bullwhip bat, buddy. You know what I'm saying? Armageddon is another example. People hate having their lands destroyed. You blow everyone's lands up, yeah, they're going to come at you. You know, they hate, and no one likes having that done to them. So it's just kind of a word of caution. If you're going to play these cards, you got to play them smart. You can't literally deploy them as an I win button, because they don't work that way. That's a huge misconception. And they don't belong in every deck in these colors either.
I definitely agree. I mean, I've seen more than my fair share of Myogen of Night's Reaches resolve, and then the person who cast them loses within a few turns. You need to make sure that you can really get an advantage out of them instead of just throwing them out there because you can. Like, if you're going to play Insurrection, you want to make sure you can kill at least one player if it resolves. If you're casting Armageddon, you want to make sure you have a dominating board presence, and the game's going to end very quickly soon after. Like, I know a lot of people just run out Armageddon because they don't have anything better to do, and they think that if they have more time, they'll be able to get back in the game. Like, that's not really what you want to do with Armageddon.
No, if you use some of these cards to some of these cards are excellent for come from behind. Some of them will let you win when you come from behind. But a card like Armageddon is not a come from behind card. Like, if you're Armageddoning when you're behind, you are screwed. And you're not going to get that time to come back, because it's another card that reads everything everyone draws from now on is coming your way. Now, something I want to talk about with these trump cards is now we have cards like Knowledge Exploitation. In case you're not familiar, it's a sorcery. And it costs 7 mana, 2 blue, and 5 colorless. And it lets you look through a target player's deck and play a card in there, an instant or a sorcery. And you don't have to pay the mana cost. So do you think that kind of thing, or things like Wild Ricochet, where you get to create a new target for a copies and you get another copy of the spell, or Twin Cast, do you think those kind of cards, if you know those are in the environment, do you think they decrease the viability of these I win buttons, so to speak?
I think they definitely do. Like, when Emrakul was in the format, and with Blightsteel Colossus now, people have to really think about whether they want to play them, because bribery is in the
format. Yeah.
And so with all the, like, with people having the capability of running Forks and Reverberates and Wild Ricochets and all that stuff, you have to think about which of these can I deal with if someone tries to resolve it against me.
Like, it's interesting, because Steven wrote that article, too, on how many people design decks that can't handle their own cards.
Right, and I think like that's something that people need to think about more. Like, Mygen of Night's Reach is fine if someone's going to bribery you because it doesn't get the divinity counter if you don't play it from your hand. Armageddon is probably fine for you to have in your deck, even if someone's going to be casting Knowledge Exploitation. Like, they can Wild Ricochet your Armageddon all they want. Those lands will really be dead.
Yeah, they'll die multiple times, which is the worst way to die. Now, I'd have to say, like, a Twin Cast and Wild Ricochet, Fork, all those things, I'd say that these cards are actually powerful enough that I'd probably still put them in a lot of decks, regardless of the presence of those. But, like, it's something that you have to think about. Because, like Steven said in his article, if you're not ready to deal with these cards, and you should be, because they're commonly played in EH anyway, but if your own deck can't deal with them, then maybe it's not the brightest idea to play them. But the reward is it can be so huge and they can be instantly game-ending that I think that most people probably will ultimately end up running them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that comes down to, like, metagaming. If you know that you're going to be playing against mono-green decks, then you can play as many of these as you want because mono-green can't touch any of them. Like, if you're playing in a metagame full of blue decks, you're probably not going to want to try to resolve any of these kinds of cards. You're probably going to try to win with more efficient combos and things like that. Like, I guess the big thing is you need to identify which ones are really poor against the kinds of decks that you regularly play against, and you need to identify how best to make sure that the ones that are good actually resolve and B, have the effect that you want them to.
Okay, now on a little bit more of what I think is an interesting note, do you think that these cards actually make EDH more fun? Because a lot of people say these are the flagship cards of the format, these big bomby spells are part of the reason they play, but it's really rare for me to see people, like, feel really great about themselves or think that they're having a really great time when someone Cabal Conditionings for 7 and everyone discards their whole hand.
I think there's a fine line that needs to be drawn. Like, I feel like Emrakul was across the line. Emrakul is not the card that I want as the flagship of the format because it resolves and someone just wins. Like, that is one of the few cards where I feel like if it resolves, generally the game is over within a few turns. But the thing is, if you start just moving down the chain, like, Emrakul is too good, now Blightsteel Colossus is too good, now Ulamog is too good, now Kozilek is too good, whatever, suddenly we're going to be attacking each other with Spined Worms and whatever, and that's not fun. That's dumb.
Yeah, I'd agree. Because, like we were talking about earlier with blue, a lot of people, you know, bag on blue because it reduces interactivity. But Insurrection isn't necessarily a particularly interactive spell. I mean, a lot of the time you cast it and you just win.
I mean, that's the thing about a lot of these cards is that most of these are not very interactive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's why they win the game, is they eliminate people's...
their options.
Their options. Yeah. Like, no, those players can no longer interact with your mechanism of taking down the game.
Mm-hmm. Because what I'm kind of seeing, and this is all, you know, purely speculation, conspiracy theory, or whatever you want to call it, is that as more sets are released, we're seeing more of those kind of cards actually being released. Like, I think that Consecrated Sphinx is an example of this. It's a card that I think they explicitly designed with the kind of EDH crowd in mind, thinking that we'll really like this, but it's just a big, dumb sledgehammer that draws a lot of cards. Like, there's nothing clever about it. I think Emrakul was the pinnacle of this. I think they thought that that would be a really popular card for the format, and then it ultimately ended up getting banned. I can't prove that that was their intention or anything like that, obviously. But, like, do you not see it as kind of being a card that was almost tailor-made for a format where you're playing big mana spells, ridiculously swingy, and people love creatures? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, there are definitely a lot more cards being designed for this format. Like, they never would have printed Praetor's Council before EDH became a big thing.
Yeah.
I think the thing that people, like, and really, if I got to say anything to R&D, this would be it. They need to realize that there are two kinds of cards that win the game. There's ones that prevent people from interacting with you, and there are ones that demand an answer immediately. And the ones that demand an answer, they're fine. Like, if everyone gets a chance to try to answer it, and if they can't, then you just win the game, like Stormherd or whatever. I'm perfectly fine with Stormherd. But, like, when something gets rid of all of your resources and you don't have a way to answer it, and, like, someone just wins the game because they ripped their Myogen of Night's Reach or whatever, like, that's not as much fun. Those are not the cards that I want to be winning the game with. Like, I feel bad when I resolve a Time Stretch or a Myogen of Night's Reach or whatever. I feel like a jerk.
Yeah.
So I'd rather win with things that are more interactive. I'd rather win with things that, like, they demand an answer, and if you don't answer them, I'm going to win, but you still get a chance to answer them.
Okay, so, like, as an example of a card that you feel was bad in this category, like, you feel that Emrakul was bad. Personally, I don't like this Consecrated Sphinx. It's not like an I win card, but you see where I'm going with this. Like, it's extraordinarily powerful. It'll put the person who plays it probably widely ahead, because I doubt anyone's going to play it without a way to protect it. So I'm not really on board with that thing. I think it's a big, dumb card that's a game winner, and it's not like you have to really think about how you're going to use it. So what do you think is an example of a good card that promotes interactivity and is still a solid trump card that can be used as a win condition?
Primeval Titan is one that I like right now, like any Titan.
Interesting.
Honestly, I like Consecrated Sphinx because you do get chances to answer it. If you have instant speed removal, that's fine. If someone untaps and wraths, it's fine. Like, it puts the blue player a little bit ahead, but it doesn't just say, I win the game. It says, I win the game if no one answers this within, like, a time around.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you don't answer it, there are other ways to attack them. Like, they can have all the cards in the world, and if you attack their mana base,
yeah, they're still
it's not going to do them a whole lot of good. So, like, there are ways to interact with it and deal with it.
Because, like, a good example for me of a card that could be considered a trump card is Lord of Extinction. Like,
yeah, that's a good one.
It's reasonably costed. It's going to hit people really hard when it comes in. It's not a clever card or anything like that, and it's really powerful, but it doesn't have any inherent protection. It doesn't have haste. You have to find a way for it to circumvent blockers. So you really have to actually kind of work around this card if you want it to be a viable win condition. So I think that was a good example.
I mean, I guess I'm just not seeing a clear distinction between that and Consecrated Sphinx. I mean, they're both big, dumb guys that do one thing really well and demand an answer.
That Sphinx just puts a nasty taste in my mouth. I don't like the amount that it showcases the power creep. I don't like how obviously it becomes way better in multiplayer. And I don't like the fact that it's giving blue an even bigger hand up in card advantage when it really doesn't need it already.
Yeah, I definitely agree. But like, that's the kind of thing.
And
that
it's also way too much of an obviously designed auto include for EDH.
Yeah.
Like, that's probably my biggest issue with it.
Yeah, I don't like when people build my decks for me. That's kind of lame.
Exactly. Yeah, I concur. Yeah, so you like Primeval Titan. See, that's a card that actually a lot of people are taking issue with now more and more. You know what I'm saying? Like, a lot of people are saying that it ramps one guy way too far ahead of the game and stuff like that. But yeah, I would agree that that's a good example. Because
the thing is, you can answer it. It's
reliably answerable, too.
Right. There are cards where if you don't answer them, they're going to win the game. Like, you can say that about any creature. Any creature that has power will
eventually
win.
Eventually, Mons, Goblin Raider will win, you know?
Right. So, like, I don't feel bad about winning with Primeval Titan when everyone gets a chance to answer it. And really, anyone else can abuse it, too.
That's another thing I want to get around to is when these cards are creature-based, in particular, they're more vulnerable to it. But we were talking about knowledge exploitation earlier, so do you think that's a legitimate reason not to put one of these super powerful cards in your deck? Like, because straight up, I don't think so. I think the reward for resolving it is way too high, even if there is that risk that someone will, say, gather specimens on it or commandeer it. Like, I will still play those cards.
It depends. It really does. Like, I will never play an Eldrazi in any deck that I plan on taking seriously, because it's way too easy to drop for a blue deck to drop like Clone or Control Magic or Sakashima. Creatures are really easy to abuse. I'm not going to touch. There are a lot of creatures that I won't play because people are playing blue decks and Control Magics and ways to steal them and things like that. Even red gets threatens and things like that. And it can be really difficult to deal with things like it can be really difficult to deal with your own creatures, really. If you tap out to play a Kozilek or whatever, and the red deck plays threaten and then hits you with your own Kozilek, I mean, that's pretty terrible.
Yeah. But like, yeah.
This spell based trump cards are a lot safer in my opinion, especially when you can use things like a Boseiju Who Shelters All, which is a rare land from Kamigawa, I think.
Yeah.
It taps for a colorless and you take 2 damage, but if you cast an instant or sorcery, that can't be countered. Like, there are easy ways to force those through, and it's really a lot harder to take advantage of someone else's spells like that.
Now, do you think that these cards are an integral part of the EDH experience?
Again, I think it comes down to the difference between ones that are easily interacted with and ones that aren't. I mean, obviously there are answers to all of them, but the reason people are playing this format is they want to interact with other players. Like, you want to see cool combos come up. You want to see things that you wouldn't see in other formats. And so when you're just going Time Stretch, Eternal Witness, Crystal Shard, Oops, I Win, like, that's not the most interesting, that's not the most interactive, and people aren't going to enjoy it. But when you're dropping, like, Lord of Extinction, then people get a chance to answer it. It's a little more interactive, and they feel like they had an opportunity to deal with it, even if they didn't actually get a chance to do anything about it.
Hmm, well put.
I'm really interested to hear what other people have to say about these kinds of things.
Yeah, definitely, because, you know, it's been said that people will complain about anything, but I think these are definitely the cards that draw the most complaints.
They do. And like, the really interesting thing is that every metagame, every group has different one of these that are problems and aren't. Like, Time Stretch has never been a problem for my group, but I know other people, if it resolves, it wins the game.
Yeah, that's one of the most common house-banned cards.
And like we were saying with Insurrection, like, I've never seen it resolve and not win a game, and you've never seen it really do anything that impressive.
Well, I've seen it win a couple of games, but certainly not with the commonality that other people speak of it having.
Yeah, so it's really interesting to hear like what metagames different trump cards are really good in and which ones they just don't do anything in.
Okay, solid. So yeah, send in your thoughts on that. Let us know what your big trump cards are too, especially if you kind of have any secret techie ones, because we didn't talk about a whole lot of individual cards here. We kind of try to stay away from that on strategy. But if you have big trump cards that you think are kind of flying under the radar, send them in, and because you know, I want to know what they are. I want to put them in my decks. So that's it for the trump card segment.
So this week, as part of the technology segment, we're going to be talking about bad cards that we love. Everyone has terrible cards they like to play in their decks. They're just fun, or you've got a little bit of a history with it or something like that. And I mean, those slots are always justifiable. Like, everyone has cards that they love to play, and it's awesome when they're relevant, and it's even awesome when they just sit there on the board.
Yeah, it's really cool when these crappy cards that we love actually win games. Because it's like I was talking about earlier, don't bust balls. Because if Bullwhip comes back and wins the game, man, that is a great feeling.
So I picked out 3 cards, and you've picked out 4, I believe?
Yeah, I've got 4.
All right, so why don't you start us off then?
Okay, so my first card, bad card that I love, and I love this card, is Bullwhip. So if you don't know what Bullwhip is, it's an artifact that was printed in Stronghold, and it costs 4 mana. So you can pay 2 colorless and tap it, and Bullwhip deals 1 damage to target creature. That creature attacks this turn if able. That's it. It doesn't really do a lot of crazy stuff, but it is hilarious. My love for this card was spawned by this really bad casual deck I had. I guess it was back... Yeah, it must have been when Mercadian Masks was printed, because I used it with Saber Ants, and my brilliant idea was to make people attack into Saber Ants. In case you don't know what Saber Ants is, it's a 4 mana green creature. I think it's a 3/4. And whenever it's dealt damage, you make that many 1/1 ant tokens. So the genius idea behind this deck was to make my opponent's biggest creatures hit the ants with the bullwhip, and then I would block, and then I would get all these ants. And then would the ants do anything other than die to pyroclasm? Probably not. You know, whatever.
But you would have them.
But the ants would be mine. And now in EDH, bullwhip is hilarious. Because if you have that guy that's sitting there with his little utility dorks that never do anything, like they come into play and then they just sit around and, you know, they're cold chilling, you hit them with bullwhip and suddenly, oh man, these guys are going in the red zone. And who knows what they're facing up against. Some of these other crappy cards I've listed? Probably. So that's my my first entry. So Carlos, why don't you go with your first one now?
Well, just to say with bullwhip, I actually saw someone who used that as like a really big part of their deck. They were playing Brigid, Hero of Kinsbale as their general.
Oh,
which is a legend
ballin'
from Lorwyn. It costs 2 and double white for a 2/3 with first strike that taps to deal 2 damage to each attacking or blocking creature target player controls. So they throw like Death Touch equipment on it and then just snipe your guys.
That's pretty sweet.
It was actually a pretty hilarious deck.
Yeah.
Or really, you can just untap Brigid a bunch of times and get the same effect. But that was a lot of fun to play with.
Plus it used Bullwhip, so style points.
I'll be honest, I've never seen anyone tutor up a Bullwhip before.
Okay, I can't say I've gone that far. But I can't say I've ever been too sad to draw it either. There have been times when you think, yeah, okay, something else would probably be better here. But would anything be more hilarious? Probably not.
So, speaking of hilarious, my first pick is Carplusian Minotaur, which is a 3/3 for 2 and double red from Cold Snap. It is a Minotaur Warrior. It has cumulative upkeep, flip a coin.
So you know this is good already.
Right there, it's worth playing. But it says, whenever you win a coin flip, the Minotaur deals 1 damage to target creature or player. And whenever you lose a coin flip, Carplusian Minotaur deals 1 damage to target creature or player of an opponent's choice. So the upside really isn't that high. I mean, you get to pick which opponent is going to choose where the damage goes. So you can probably pretend you won the flip either way if you pick the right opponent.
It's actually interesting politically because of that.
But, I mean, really, it's not... You're not playing it to get some extra damage out. You're playing it to troll people by flipping coins from your upkeep.
Coins everywhere. Now you know this combos, eh? Kark's thumb.
Oh man.
Mad synergy. Also, you know what it would actually be hilarious to play this with proliferate cards too. To increase the number of age counters on it and get more coin flips.
And a chance encounter. That terrible enchantment from Odyssey, what does that do?
I think it's if you win 10 or more coin flips, you win the game.
Whenever you win a coin flip, you put a luck counter on it. And at the beginning of your upkeep, if it has 10 or more luck counters, you win the game.
Actually, with enchantment for that would be 4. Pretty baller.
Yeah, that could be hilarious.
Fascinating. I think we have a deck in the making. So yeah, Carplusian Minotaur, check that shit out. The one thing, be careful about putting Death Touch equipment on it, which a lot of people will automatically go to. Because then all one guy has to do is be like, you know, I've had enough of this Minotaur. It'll just shoot itself. And then it's like it shoots itself in the head, and it's a sad Minotaur. No one wants to see that. So my next pick, it's hilarious how many of these are red cards. I picked Cyclops Gladiator. Now, no one was excited for this card but me. But I think my love of red is well documented. So if you're not familiar with this, it's a newer card. It costs 1 colorless and triple red. As soon as I saw that, I knew this had to go into a deck. It's a Cyclops Warrior from M11, and it's a 4/4. So whenever it attacks, it can deal damage equal to its power to target creature defending player controls. And if you do that, the creature it hits it back with its own power. So basically, it's arena on legs. It's a 4/4 for 4, which is reasonable. But that's not why you use it. You use it because this guy is running illegal pit fights on the side, and he is the main attraction. Now, that is just awesome. In the same vein, I also love Tangarth the Talrun Hero. He's a 4/4 for 5, 2 red, 3 colorless, and he has vigilance, and then you can pay a red and a colorless and tap him, and he does the arena ability. So I just really like arena abilities. Cyclops Gladiator is hilarious, especially in EDH, because he snipes dorks. If your guy has his little wall of omens there, this thing bats it out of the way and goes in for the hit. If your friend is playing something stupid trying to get an infinite combo like that Knotvine Elder or Priest of Titania, this guy, see that giant mace? Yeah, that's probably hitting an elf that's trying to do something utility related, you know? That's just how Cyclops Gladiator rolls. But it actually has some legitimate uses as well, which is always a plus. Like, if you put Mage Bane armor on it, it no longer suffers the retaliatory attack, and it can hit something that's slightly larger. And that play has actually won me games. In case you're not familiar with Mage Bane armor, it's a piece of equipment. It gives something +2/+4. It takes away flying, and then it doesn't take non-combat damage. So the Cyclops Gladiator's arena ability is non-combat, so it can sneak in a couple extra hits against some bigger targets. So it's just a fun card. You probably won't win very many games directly because of it, but, I mean, come on. Come on, guys. Cyclops Gladiator. Let's get this going here. All right, so we'll move on to, Martyr of Sands? I think that's always a good pick, because this is the kind of thing that the Cyclops Gladiator crushes.
Yeah, Martyr of Sands is a card that I really like.
I can attest this. This is an almost uncomfortable amount of love that he feels for this card. It's almost up there with, Ranger of Eos? But that's like on a whole new level. Adam and Oracle of Moldiah level.
Well, Ranger of Eos has to go get something, right? I started playing this card when, like, sometimes you're just that guy, and whatever deck you bring to the table, it doesn't matter. You're getting hated off.
That's a great way to introduce the card.
So sometimes you just have to play a deck that doesn't die. And Martyr of Sands is really good at making sure you don't die, especially when you have, like, Nimdeath Mantle or Emyria or any number of other ways to just recur it over and over. You can gain like 18 life per cycle easily. So it's a really good way to just make sure that you're not dying. The deck that I originally played it in was a Darien King of Keldor deck. He is a 3/3 for 6. Whenever you take damage, you put a 1/1 soldier into play.
You really like Cold Snap, eh?
There are some gems in that set. No matter how bad it was, there were some gems in that set.
The only person I know that really liked Cold Snap.
I'm pretty sure that just about every deck I have has at least one card from Cold Snap in it. There are some pretty good gems in there.
There are certainly some things. I think that you kind of think outside the box, though. Martyr of Sands, I mean,
in the same vein, Martyr of Spores is very similar. It's a green for a 1/1, and you pay one and sack it. Reveal any number of green cards in your hand. Target creature gets +X/+X, where that's the number of cards. Like, that's a really easy way to get in for, like, an absurd amount of general damage.
Yeah, it's actually pretty good.
Like, all of the Martyrs, except for Martyr of Frost, are actually pretty... They're playable. They're not great, but they're definitely playable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Martyr of Sands is actually pretty good. People will laugh at you when you play it. That's a theme with your cards. People will laugh, and then they lose the game. I'm kind of like, oh, maybe that wasn't so bad after all. Most of them will just get laughed at and not win games.
Well, once you win a game with it, then... they take the card seriously, and you're still that guy, even though you were trying not to be.
I will say that if you actually win a game with Martyr of Sands by beating someone to death with it, like, oh no. You know, that's just wrong. That's not how that should go. All right, so my next pick is Menacing Ogre. So, and he is menacing. This was a rare. It was printed in Onslaught. It costs 3 colorless and 2 red, and it's an ogre creature type. 3/3. Trample and Haste sounds almost good enough on the power curve for back then. When Menacing Ogre comes into the battlefield, each player secretly chooses a number. I don't know how many cards have the word secretly printed on them in Magic, but this is one of them. Then those numbers are revealed. Each player with the highest number loses that much life. If you are one of those players, put 2 +1/+1 counters on Menacing Ogre. If you can't find the comedic value in this card, then you have no soul. Like,
this is one of the cards that made me get back into the game during
really
Onslaught. This card was so awesome. This card was so good.
Look at him. He's hustling that guy on the art too hard, like just collecting all them coins. But seriously, when you play it and like people are gambling amounts of life, how many cards make people do that in Magic? Think carefully. Not many. Menacing Ogre is one. It has the word secretly in the rules. It doesn't describe how you're supposed to record these life numbers people are writing down. Every time I play it with a new group of people, they're like, so how does this work? Like, what do we do? Like, do we pick something in our head and we're on the honesty system? Like, it's just so awesome and weird. And then on the plus side, you never know. Maybe you'll have that one guy that will pay, like, 6 life. And you're like, joke's on you. I just burned you for 6 life for this shitty creature, you know? And on the plus side, if people don't take it seriously... and you pay one life and it comes into play as a trample haste with 5/5, that's actually pretty good. So
yeah, that's definitely above curve.
Yeah, it's good. So I'm not going to argue that this is like secret tech and like you need to get this in your decks stat. Like menacing ogres are going to be flying off the shelves. No, probably not. But should you play with it for the hilarity factor? I think it figures into a lot of types of decks, especially those like chaos decks. People just play them for a laugh, even though normally they're more frustrating than funny. But yeah, you know what? Just throw menacing ogre into a deck. Just like sneak it in and just see what people do. Just play it once. You know, that's all I'm saying.
I mean, really, those kinds of cards are what this format is all about.
Well, maybe it was at some point, but that's a topic for another day. Okay, so what's your next pick?
All right, so my next pick is a cycle of creatures from Mercadian Mask. They're Rishadan Cutpurse, Rishadan Footpad, and Rishadan something else I can't remember. They're pirates, so I play them in my Ramirez Deep Getro pirate-themed deck. Rishadan Cutpurse is a 1/1 for 2 and a blue. And when it comes into play, each opponent sacrifices a permanent unless they pay one. Rishadan Footpad is 2/2 for 4, and it's the same thing, but they have to sacrifice a permanent unless they pay 2. And the last one costs 5, and it's a 3/3, and they have to sacrifice something unless they pay 3. These guys are pretty terrible, but they're pirates. There's only like there's only like 17 pirates in the entire game that aren't changelings, and really that's pretty lame.
That's good enough, as far as I'm concerned,
right,
to make them good.
So, I mean, it feels really good when you get one person with a Rishadan Cutpurse. There have been times that I've gotten, like, 3 or even 4 people with it, and that feels so good.
Really,
You just got infinite value out of Rishadan Cutpurse.
They should feel terrible about themselves for losing permanents to this card. That is awful. But, you know, it comes down pretty early. Like, people are still developing their boards. Like, a lot of times guys are tapping out for further mana ramp and whatever.
Right,
and then suddenly you're cutting their purse. Like, who saw that coming?
And then sometimes you even get them for one every once in a while.
Yeah, extra value. I will say, too, that the flavor text on Rishadan Footpad is great. The best things in life are free. Money, for instance. And he's, like, just cold-cocking this goblin. Oh, that's slick. So, yeah, these are all brilliant. What's the third one?
Rishadan
the airship.
Rishadan Brigand. It's a 3/2 flying for 5, and they have to sacrifice something unless they pay 3. Can only block creatures with flying. So that one's actually playable on its own.
Yeah, that's actually not that bad. That's like a quality Mercadian Masks rare, you know? Mind you, Mercadian Masks rare, that's kind of its own special category, but I digress. All right, so my final pick is actually a cycle as well. It's the Song Cycles from Urza's Saga. For those not familiar, there's an entire cycle of cards, and there is one at uncommon and one at rare. And they're groups of enchantments, and during your upkeep, you put verse counters on them, and then you pay and sacrifice them, and they do X of something, where X is the number of verse counters on them. Some of them are really good, some of them are really bad. They're all kind of funny, because there's just not that many things that put verse counters on objects. Rumbling Crescendo is my favorite, because I love red, and it destroys lands, which I also love doing, and people hate this card. But playing it with Proliferate makes it actually pretty good. It becomes actually kind of scary. As long as you have a red open, people know that you can go and selectively snipe a couple of lands. And it's quite good like that. Most of them aren't great. The black one that makes people discard cards is pretty good as well. I'm not going to read them all out loud because it's like 10 cards, so I don't want to waste all that time. The white one that destroys artifacts and enchantments is okay.
Sarah's Liturgy.
Yeah, like that one's pretty good too. The thing is, they're slow, they're easy targets, they'll get caught up in coincidental sweepers like in Necroma's Vengeance all the time, but it feels pretty rad when you have your Contagion Engine out, and you're proliferating and putting 2 counters on them every turn, and they're getting huge, and then you just unleash this giant, like, horrible song on everyone, and somehow that just lays waste to them. Like, how many cards are killing people by singing in Magic? I don't know a whole lot. I guess those Muses are doing their thing. But that's pretty much it. So, in case you haven't noticed, I like abnormal words on cards like verse counter and secretly. Maybe it's my unique/challenged sense of humor, but I really like these cards. So give them a go. They're actually, like I said, they're actually pretty good in a deck with a strong, as strong as it can be, proliferate theme. Otherwise, they're not that good, but they are fun to play. So give them a go. And Carlos, I think you got your last card on here, yeah.
Yeah, I actually have one more cycle. These are guards that I love to death. There's an article I wrote about these coming out at some point, either before or after this. They are Zuberas. They're from Champions of Kamigawa, and they are all 1/2s for one and a colored mana. And when they go into a graveyard, you get a generic effect, but you do it once for each Zubera that was put into a graveyard that turn. So, for example, the black one is 1 and a black for a 1/2, and when it dies, target opponent discards a card for each Zubera that died that turn. The blue one is draw a card, the green one is 1/1 spirit tokens. So these guys are kind of hilarious because you're trying to find ways to kill as many of them as possible. They're suicidal. They want to go. So, like, these are awful in just about every deck. You're never going to just throw them in.
The worst part is, though, they're like a cult suicide thing. Like, they want to die, but they want to die together, you know? In a way, it's sad and tragic and awesome, but mostly crappy.
Yeah, I mean, I've tried to abuse these in every format that they have ever been legal in, and I've always failed. And this format is the first one where I've managed to do it. There are enough sac outlets and enough good changelings. Like, if you have some changelings and some sac outlets, you can consistently draw, like, 5 or 6 cards off of a Floating Dream Zubera without trying. And they're especially good when you're running all of them. You play, like, you sac all your Zuberas to something, you play Second Sunrise and get them all back with the triggers still on the stack, you sac them all again, do some more stuff, hope for the best. I mean, you can get some pretty good value out of them.
See, like, listen to this guy. Like, I'm talking about, like, oh, yeah, and, you know, then I killed his elf. And this guy's talking about, like, drawing 8 cards off these terrible cards and then doing it over and over again. Like, this is why you email him for deck building advice and not me ever, okay? Let's just make that clear.
Well, look, to be fair, I've been trying to make this work since they've been legal. When was Champions printed? Like, 5 years ago?
Yeah, it was a while
Something
ago.
Something like that. I have been dying for these to be playable for the longest time.
And they still aren't, but you keep trying. And that's admirable.
You keep trying.
Yeah. It's all you can do is try, you know? Work with what they give you, I suppose.
Eventually, there'll be a critical mass of, like, Patriarch's Bidding and Second Sunrise and Cauldron Haze and all these things that let you get your guys back another time.
It's only
eventually.
A matter of time. You sound very optimistic about this. I hope it goes well for you.
I can't wait to get someone with the Zubera combo of the deck.
All right, so as you can tell, this is a great subject for us, and we're very interested. Like, if you're going to send us email about one thing, ever, like, let's do this. Come on, guys. Bad cards you love. Everyone has them. Let's hear them. Maybe we can even do, like, a little gallery on the CommanderCast website of, like, really crappy cards that we all just slot into decks, like, kind of like, oh, I meant to take that out, you know, when someone starts making fun of you for it. So, yeah, you know, get back to us on these bad cards that you love. I'm sure we're going to have a pretty good list of them going soon. So that wraps up this episode of CommanderCast. I hope you guys all enjoyed the show, as usual, especially anybody that's new that's just coming on board. So, like I was talking about through the whole show, in case you're only hearing the audio here, here's where you can find our show notes. They're at CommanderCast.com. And we've always got links there related to the show, links for the cards that we discuss typically in our technology segment, that kind of thing. You can get a hold of me personally. I'm CommanderCast@gmail.com. It's the show's general email, but just send that. That's the easiest way to get a hold of me personally as well. Carlos, what's your email?
My email is CAG5383@gmail.com. And if you have any deck ideas, if you have any lists that you want help with, or even if you just have some constructive criticism of the articles that have been going up, I'd be really glad to hear from you. I'm pretty new to this writing thing, and any advice that you've got, I'd appreciate it.
Right on.
Obviously, I've got a number of terrible ideas for decks that I'd be glad to share with people, but I mean, I really would prefer for it to be more like a community kind of article than just me putting up terrible ideas every week.
although there's certainly always room for that, especially Commander Cast. The easier ways to get a hold of me as well include Twitter. I'm at Commander Cast. I'm not a big Twitter guy, but I do check it pretty much every day just in case. I'm also on, and we're both actually on MTG Salvation and the official EDH forums. My username there is Ghosts. And what's yours, Carlos?
I have a couple different ones because they're left over. On MTG Salvation, I'm CAG08055. And on the official website, I am 914.
Okay. So, that's it for this week's episode. As usual, hope you guys enjoyed it. And feel free to get back to us with any feedback that you've got, because we really appreciate that.